never forget the first moment when I walked into a cinema. I was hooked from there on.
And so forth.
Hello, and welcome to Scon On Podcast number 53.
Da, 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 da.
Original score by Jason Coyle.
Yeah, I'm here all week. The second year. We're in the second year.
Feels like longer.
It feels like a lot longer.
Didn't you miss a couple, though?
Nobody asked you, Darren.
Okay.
And it was more than a couple.
Yeah.
And I've missed a couple by not being here. Okay, I missed one.
I've checked out on a few, but that's a different issue.
Anyway, as you can hear, we're all present and correct. Well, I don't know about correct, but we're present anyway.
We certainly are.
Well, nominally. Yeah. I'm here, Jay's here, and Darren.
Hello!
Yes, that's Darren, in case anybody didn't know.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't be do anything that cheery, nor would Philip.
Yes. Anyway, what have we been watching this week, Jay?
Okay. I've got two plus one in the top ten, but I'll keep the top 10 months till the top ten.
Do?
Yeah. First, My Neighbor Totoro.
Oh.
Because, why not? Because it's amazing.
It is.
Absolutely beautiful.
He's so cute.
It's...
I wanted Totoro.
It's the cat bus. Sorry.
I'm sorry, but who... How high would any Western animator have to be to come up with a cat bus?
I'd agree.
Only the deranged mind of Hayao Miyazaki could do that.
There's the thing about watching Ghibli films, which I always find fascinating, in that every time you watch one, it gets closer to your top of the list of his films. And then you watch something else, and it gets pushed down because something else is gone. And it's just...
And then you rewatch it.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of my favourites. It's not necessarily the best, even though it'd be up quite high in the list. I still think Grave of the Fireflies is the greatest thing to come out of that studio. The hardest to watch, but it's extraordinary.
It is, but I don't know how many people would actually agree with you that it's the best.
I would say
Stardust, I would.
Oh, well.
As much as I loved.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, well, there's something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Totoro is definitely one of those perennial ones that always is at the top. It's usually that, Mononoke, Spirited Away.
No argument for you. Like, catch me another day and I'd say one of those and defend it today, particularly after I've just watched them.
Which one will it be next week? Tune in to find out.
The excitement levels are building here.
Yes, they've doubled in the last 2 minutes.
Yes. Next week, Philip will have cake and balloons. You won't see them, of course.
Neither will you.
No. But it's wonderful. But we all know that.
Yes, we do.
No matter which people we talk about, we all know that they're wonderful.
So what else have you watched then?
Run All Night.
Yeah. So I'm guessing another glowing review.
There's a curious kind of almost car crash sensibility to watching Liam Neeson films these days. Like, the new one is going to be like the last one in some way. But you just want to say, maybe they'll do something different. Maybe they'll change it up a bit.
I call that Jason Statham syndrome.
Yeah.
Well, it's more like what force, what center of gravity does he exert, and who's he pulled into his orbit this time?
This time it's Ed Harris, which is not a bad,
pretty good.
Yeah, don't talk about Ed Harris, no argument with that. The story really... I know.
Story, do you hear him with story? The plot.
Like, it has several opportunities throughout the film to go down an unexpected path. Takes none of them to go towards absolutely every path you'd expect. And it's serviceable nonsense that I've largely forgotten and I only watched it at the weekend. I mean, it's okay. It's got the violence. It's got Ed Harris chewing it up.
I'd say it's okay if you like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I didn't hate it, but I was so bored and crushed by its lack of interest in its own self. It's just pedestrian.
So
isn't
not
even...
hate, just bored and crushed.
Yeah.
Rave of the century.
It is. It's the Liam Neeson Mad Lib. It's something, something, something alcoholic, something, something, something son, something, something gun.
Pretty much that. Exactly that. Repeat until we get to the end.
Yeah.
Okay.
Next snap's optional.
Yeah, I mean, one day, like, he'll come back to us, but
that new Scorsese, we're all holding our breaths.
I'm sure there's another truckload. There'll probably be two releases between that.
Between them, yeah.
Like, Neeson's fine in these roles. It's just that it doesn't... Like, He looks bored.
He is the one thing keeping it together.
Yeah, but he looks bored by himself. I don't believe any of the lines he said in there, because he doesn't believe any of the lines he says, doesn't he? You know, it's that kind of thing. It's like,
but he knows he can sell this.
Yeah.
He can come out unscathed.
Well, to be fair, yeah, all of his characters are tired, depressed, and browbeaten. And you get a sense that there's a little bit of method going there.
Or else there's more than a little bit tired, and depressed, and browbeaten in Neeson for the last few years.
Yeah.
Yes.
But he's taking a dollar.
So
he's taking a dollar. He's read the script. He knows what he's in for. He's only, no one to blame but himself.
Yeah,
it doesn't stand out amongst the 500 he's done.
Fair enough.
That's all I can tell you.
Can't the rest.
I can't wait to watch the next one and forget about that one.
It's called Run All Night, Jeff.
Run All Night 2. Run All Night to avoid this one, I would say.
Cold.
So yeah,
Darren,
that's all I got.
Was your watching this week as emotional a roller coaster as that?
Actually, it was, yeah, so a bunch of rewatches, something in the top 10, some new stuff, etc. So
save us that.
A smorgasbord of
a veritable smorgasbord of reasonably okay films, occasionally tipping into very good.
Okay.
First thing I did was I rewatched Silence of the Lambs, because there's, you know, for no reason whatsoever, completely unrelated to anything that might or might not be airing on television.
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
I'd forgotten how good it was, which is odd.
It is the best of the Hannibal films, but I don't rate it quite as highly as everybody else.
Neither do I. I disagree. I think Manhunter is the best of the Hannibal films. But what Silence of the Lambs does have, and what I love about it, and how brilliantly written the script is,
it is a great script.
That the scene, the throw you at the house where Jodie Foster arrives at the door, and it's
a misdirection that for 20
extraordinary.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's so beautifully so constructed, that final scene.
But they've been doing it for 20 years, which is perhaps a sign of, you know, exactly how good it is, where you have like the cops arriving. But I mean, it's funny you should say the script, because I actually, you know, it's one of those things where you go to and you notice, or at least I notice different things each time. Like, I love how Dem, for example, I remember when I was a kid, when I was a youngster and foolish and all this sort of stuff, I remember thinking that Silence of the Lambs actually looked quite cheap, because I was foolhardy.
Oh, it's a very well-designed, well-produced film.
I think I was building to that.
Okay, fine.
Spoilers, people.
Get on with it.
But no, what I notice is that it's the way that Dem typically frames the shots, so he shoots them head-on at eye level. I think that was something that when I was a kid I thought was a very boring way to shoot a film, but now I sort of appreciate that it's a great way of sort of putting you in the shoes of characters. So when characters have conversations, he doesn't typically frame them in wide shot. They're not typically together. He cuts back and forth between them so as to put you where they are.
And not in an over-the-shoulder kind of way.
No. Like
When Hopkins is standing in the cell and he makes that noise, he's looking right at
you. You're typically staring right at him. And it's a weird film where you get the sense that most of the character interactions you could convert to 4:3 for television back in the early 90s, and you would lose very little of the impact of, I think. But I think it's masterfully constructed. Like it is superb.
I saw that in the cinema when it came out, and the hysterical newspaper articles I particularly remember from America of people fainting in the cinema and refusing to leave their seats.
Like The Exorcist.
There was like 3 or 4 page pullouts of, you know, hand wringing people of what kind of monsters create. It's remarkably tame in a lot of ways now.
Oh yeah.
Like really, yeah. And it's like, we're only talking about 91.
Remarkable for being a very early Oscar winner. And when I say very early Oscar winner, I mean in terms of the year when it was released. It was almost a whole year between it being released.
And it won all the major ones as well.
It did, which
the
is...
The Big Five.
You get this...
Certainly for a thriller, really, isn't it? Which essentially all it is.
Yeah.
Well made.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, when you get people sort of feeling bad about the Oscars or complaining about, like, the state of play or they've gone all sort of, you know, prestige-y or whatever... I think that's what you're missing. Like, you would never get a film like that winning today, I don't think. And
probably
you'd
certainly
not.
But you got Gone Girl nominated, I suppose, for
Best Actress.
But
not Best Picture.
No, I'm not saying it's that.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to think of even anything pulpy that kind Pulp Fiction.
But even the time gap between it, where something comes out and it doesn't have, like, an army of publicists. It doesn't have a publicity budget that is, like, twice what it costs to actually make the thing.
Yeah.
So I thought it was remarkable. And it is a genre film. Like, I mean, for as you said, for all the people talk about it being like a masterpiece, and it is. It's a masterpiece of genre film. Like, it's arguably the first horror film to win the Oscar.
It's a very good film. Okay, I'd stop short on masterpiece, but I think the years have diminished its power.
Really?
I think it's a little bit.
You mean imitation, or?
Yeah, maybe that's a part of it.
Well, funnily enough, I think one thing about it, the one reason it's lost some of its power, is not so much imitation as that is improvement, dare I say, because it did spawn a lot of, well, copycats, and copycat was one of them. Apex is probably 7.
Yeah.
But it did spawn a lot of them.
Influential in that regard.
Very. Since then, well, it's, you know, Anthony Hopkins as Hannibal. It wasn't until Heath Ledger played the Joker that a lot of people saw a boogeyman that they felt matched him.
Also won the Oscar.
Yes, indeed.
Talk about that, though, that... I rewatched it, I think, early last year. Mm. Hopkins still comes across quite hammy.
He does.
Seven years gone back. Like, I mean...
He's having fun with the role.
He is. When I saw that initially, the impact of that was very different to the impact of now, and that's why I think it diminishes the power of the film.
Oh, in that, like, you've seen Hannibal now.
Yeah,
like,
exactly,
You've seen him, you know, you've seen him.
He's very easy. That's probably my big issue with the film, in that I enjoy Hopkins, but he is just so different to everything else in the film.
Foster's great.
Yeah, Foster's phenomenal. But just in general.
But he's just so...
He's funny, and he delivers the lines very good, though. But he's in a different film.
He's toying with her, and he's having a ball.
Yeah.
So fair enough.
But I think that Dem controls it better than, say, Scott did, and certainly better than Ratner did. In that, like,
agreed.
Like the Hopkins sequence of the film, there's 17 minutes, but there's 70 minutes that are consciously separate.
And he's very well aware of less is more in that regard because you're not revealing the full hand of it.
Yeah. So I saw that.
We're still on that. Let's keep going.
Phil's making like spinning hand gestures now. Mooney Family Movie Time. Here we go. 71. Over the weekend, which is actually quite good.
It's good, isn't it?
I really liked it. It's very sort of a claustrophobic movie set in Belfast.
It never stops moving, does it?
Yeah, well, that's the appeal of it, I think. I think if it did stop moving...
But it does occasionally, then you kind of...
It slows down, but it doesn't stop.
There's a great couple of great sequences in it. The explosion.
Oh, the explosion. It's a long take.
And even
the climax, incredibly claustrophobically constructed and stuff like that.
And Jack O'Connell is just terrific.
Yeah.
Well, Jack O'Connell is great. He was even good in Unbroken, which is terrible.
I haven't seen Unbroken either.
It's Angelina Jolie doing her best Clint Eastwood impression. It's not great.
I still want to see it, though. I'm intrigued. I just haven't got around to it.
All right. So we saw that, and then we also watched Wild.
Oh, dear.
Wild is like the Get Reese Witherspoon Oscar nomination film, and it sort of failed at that, which gives you perhaps an indication of how it works.
Let me put it this way. It's Eat, Pray, Love's slightly older and less showy cousin.
Less showy.
It's showboating, but it's not as insipidly stupid as Eat, Pray, Love.
Well, there's like... Nick Hornby's script is like...
It's terrible, don't get me wrong.
It beats you over the head with everything. Like, there's a bit where the lead character has an epiphany about, like, trying to save her life by going on this long walk along the Pacific Trail. And it's played, like, as she's trying to figure out a reason to keep living. The song, Give Me a Reason, plays over the soundtrack and a montage for like 2 full minutes.
Yeah.
You know, it is not a film that's
subtle. It is not.
Yeah.
So I never said subtle. No. I said a lot of things, but subtle is not one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and the main character also leaves her signature at the various trails by quoting more famous, sort of more eloquent individuals.
Yeah, I hated her for that. I hate the lead character. I don't know why I cared. It's the pretty cinematography, and Witherspoon decided to go without her spoon and just...
I like it.
I mean, she throws herself into the role, but it doesn't change the fact the character is just, I hate her.
Yeah, no, I think her performance is great, and I actually really like Laura Dern. Laura Dern is great in everything.
She is a national treasure, isn't she?
Yeah, she really is. Sadly underappreciated. Enlightened was pretty good.
I didn't see Enlightened, that's on my list.
It's quite good. Now, it's perhaps underrated.
Yeah.
But Wild is not.
Wild is not.
That's the irony of Wild. It's quite tame, really.
I wasn't wild about it.
No, indeed not.
It led me off the
Beaten Trail.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, moving on. All right, a bit early for this.
All right, fine. And then that's me. We'll talk about the other films later.
Excellent. Young Philip.
Me, I had just one rewatch. I've both I'm pretty happy about. During the week, I interviewed John Boorman.
Ooh. Excellent.
Very nice man. In preparation for that, and in preparation for his new film, Queen and Country, which we'll talk more about later, I rewatched Hope and Glory. Either of you ever seen it?
Quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
I did like it.
It's good.
I don't remember loving it, but I remember liking it.
It's basically a retelling of his memories from growing up in the suburbs of London during the Blitz.
Nice, very evocative.
Extremely evocative. It's so well designed, so well built.
Yeah.
And in that regard, as an evocation of a time, it's great. But plot-wise, it's episodic.
Yeah.
But I forgive it that because it is very likeable, wonderful cast, and just for recreating that time and the sense of just trying to hold civilization together and doing it pretty admirably too. I really liked it. It's a kind of atmosphere and mood that he strives for in Queen and Country. But did he achieve it? Well, stay tuned and find out.
My nerves. Anyway.
Nurse!
So how was the interview? Would you say it was interesting or was he a bore man?
Oh my God. He was very pleasant and we talked for quite a while.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Excellent.
Indeed. Yeah. That interview can be found on the website. Give it a read.
Do.
Anyway, on that bombshell, nowhere near finished. Don't get your hopes up.
And here comes the good stuff, people.
Yes, indeed.
This was your order. This is a...
Yeah, this is the main course.
Good God. Let's start. Just a bit of casting news. Jack Rayner, for his heat, has been cast in Ben Wheatley's new film, Free Fire. And I want to talk about this because it's a Ben Wheatley film. And dear God, High Rise, I want it now.
Where is it? Where's the trailer? I want to see something. I want to feel it. I'm saying
I want it to touch me deep inside.
I want to be touched deep inside by this film. Also, what's it called? Free Fire?
That too, maybe.
Ben Wheatley is always worth talking about.
Jay, stop talking, Jay. You freaked me out here.
Good.
It's a J.G. Ballard film, so I suppose if he wants to be violated, there's an irony there.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, we don't know when. Hopefully later this year.
We're all hoping for Cannes. Alas, no.
No Cannes too.
Yeah.
Yes. Toronto, Venice maybe, who knows. In the meantime, Wheatley just keeps going, and he started shooting his first American film, Free Fire. Alongside Rayner, already in place, are his Glassland co-star Michael Smiley, because he's great.
Yeah, everyone does like Michael Smiley.
Who?
Everyone does like Michael Smiley.
Oh, yeah. Lord knows I do. He's great. Alongside them are Cillian Murphy, Olivia Wilde, Luke Evans, and Armie Hammer.
Solid cast,
isn't it?
I like it.
Executive produced by Martin Scorsese.
Oh,
he knows a good thing, does Marty?
Yeah. Hard-boiled crime film from the 70s, so... Safe ground.
Yeah, it's going to be safe ground with Ben Wheatley.
I'm going to make a statement. It's going to be better than
Black Mass.
Well, no, I was thinking more. What was the one with Oscar Isaacs that you love?
Most Violent Year.
I liked it.
It was awful. Awful film.
Jay, tell us what you really think.
God awful.
It's not bad.
Don't ever see it, people. It's horrendous.
Give it a watch. It's an interesting genre piece.
Phil is not at all biased by Jessica Chastain.
I like the film for what it is.
Anyway, move on. Let's go.
A piece of flawed interest. Right, moving on to other news close to home. Applications are open to volunteer at the 27th Galway Film Flat.
And if I was 20 odd years younger, I would probably do it.
So if you're
14. Anyway, no. But it does sound like fun.
Yeah. By all accounts, these things are fun. I've never volunteered to these things.
I don't volunteer for anything.
I don't have the energy.
Far too cynical for that.
Yes.
Indeed. But if you're interested in volunteering, do get in touch with the Galway Film Flat. The duties include taking tickets, ushering, sales, transportation, registration, so on and so forth.
Parties. We can't guarantee parties.
I believe those kind of things are... They're very sociable, so there will be parties.
I've heard they're sociable.
Yes.
Anyway, details are available on the Galway Film Flat's website.
Excellent.
A season we want to talk about, Punk on Film. This is being hosted at the Triskel Christchurch in Cork. They're doing a season of punk films, and who doesn't love a good punk film?
What are they showing? Tell me, Philip.
Well, the classic, of course, The Filth and the Fury.
Yeah.
Punk in London, Rude Boy, and The Damned, Don't You Wish We Were Dead.
Yes.
I think a lot of people do wish The Damned. Actually, I'd be surprised if they're not.
More on that story later.
We'll come back to death, unfortunately, soon. But yes, that is a season that's happening from the 19th to the 22nd of July. So if only to see The Filth and the Fury. Yeah. Please do. Go along if you're in Cork.
Ronan Doyle, get thee there.
Well, he is back from Transylvania now, so he bloody well better. Oh dear, yes. Anyway, that's a sad note that I'm afraid I have to strike. At the time of broadcast, we've just heard of a few notable passings, starting with the death just a few days ago of Richard Johnson, at the age of 87. He made his debut in the 50s. He was a founding member of the Royal Shakespeare Company, appeared in numerous TV dramas. He's known for, well, there's an interesting note. His second wife was Kim Novak.
Nice! That's a word of life, isn't it?
That is a word of life.
Good lord.
Yeah, but he's also famous for appearances in films such as The Haunting, the original.
Oh, wait, I would hope so.
And Khartoum, and Deadlier Than the Male. And a sequel, Some Girls Do. But he was best known for being a respected Shakespearean actor. If you want to watch a notable appearance, the BBC production of Shakespeare's Cymbeline alongside Helen Mirren. He was one of those fine character actors and presences that a very respectable that guy from that thing, you could say.
And he was married to Kim Novak.
Oi,
oi, oi. Some people have all the luck.
For you nostalgics,
that's really probably not the thing to say in an obituary.
Hey, he was 87. That's not bad. Okay. 87, I'm married to Kim Novak. I take that now.
For all you nostalgics out there, consider yourself warned. Ron Moody has passed. Fagin from Cara Reid's Oliver has passed at the age of 91.
Also a terrific innings.
Indeed. Well, yes. He is best known for playing Fagin in Oliver. He also appeared in EastEnders.
Oh, good lord. Don't mention that.
A lot of people will know him for that.
EastEnders, though. It's a film podcast, not a crappy soap podcast.
Coronation Street are better.
Coincidentally, I'll be hosting the crappy soap podcast later.
Hope you'll join us.
Yeah. Good lord. No, yeah, that's a sad one.
Indeed. Played a lot of stage parts as well. He played Captain Hook numerous times, played Uriah Heep and David Copperfield. And strangely enough, a lot of people probably remember him as Merlin in A Kid in King Arthur's Court. Hmm. Which is a terrible film, but it's worth watching to see a young Kate Winslet and a young Daniel Craig.
I'm probably not going to watch it, but okay.
Yeah. Anyway, and finally, and almost definitely the biggest loss, Sir Christopher Lee.
Wow.
Today, at the time of recording, at the age of 93.
That's a good run. He fit a lot in.
Yeah. Well, it's still recording heavy metal.
I mean, 200 film credits.
Oh, good lord.
224, I believe.
There you go.
Death metal albums and various other things aside.
He celebrated his 92nd birthday by releasing a death metal cover of My Way.
And he did. He did indeed.
Oh, indeed.
That makes me very lazy. I feel very lazy in comparison. Yeah. As do I imagine a lot of people just thinking about it.
Just think about the roles he played. So many. Dracula.
Yeah, I tweeted earlier, my mother
so many horror watched that.
Was a big horror fan, and she always loved Christopher Lee as Dracula because, quote unquote, he was a good Dracula. It was none of that filth in it. It was an old fashioned Dracula. I didn't care to mention to her that Hammer got a little racier as time went on.
She wasn't a Lugosi fan.
No, she was a Christopher Lee fan. Nailed her thing to the mast, and that one she loved her. Lovely.
He was one of the definitive Draculas. Dracula's lucky in that he has a few definers.
Yeah.
I would say Shrek, Lugosi, and Lee. If you want to throw in
Gary Oldman.
I was waiting for that.
Oldman's okay, though.
Yeah, the film less so.
The film is messy. It's interesting, but it's messy.
Yeah, but Lee, just there was an earthiness, and just an elegant threat, and which I think is what Lee did.
The
so
Wicker
well,
Man is the thing for that is real the, film fans.
That he said it, he said it himself that that was the best role he ever had and the best film he was in, and I can't disagree.
No,
I love that film so much, and I'm gonna have to rewatch it on some stage. That's gonna be tough.
Oh, I got it. I'm gonna do the same.
And now for our more dreadful sacrifice. Ouch. Which is, I could believe him ruling an island like that.
He could rule a universe, and I'd believe it.
Well, for more on that, you can look at the Star Wars prequels.
Oh, yeah, or the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, the Lord of the Rings.
So there's lots of great stories, actually. As you might imagine with Christopher Lee, there are lots of great stories that people have sort of venom. And it's interesting to wonder how much of them are actually true and how much of them are just legends. Like, so, for example, when interviewers bring up the subject of what he did in the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare during the Second World War, he'd always, you know, gesture the reporters over to him, whisper in their ear, "Can you keep a secret?" To which they'd say, "Yes." And he'd go, "So can I," and tap his nose. Or the wonderful story about Peter Jackson when he was filming like a fight sequence in Lord of the Rings, you know, saying like he loved the way that Christopher Lee was doing it. But he's like, "Next time we do it, I want you to make a sound like he's actually stabbing you through the heart and you're dying." Christopher Lee goes, "That was the sound I was making."
I heard a story. He was accepting an honorary award from a society in University College Dublin a few years back. My workplace. Hello.
Yeah.
And there was a Q&A afterwards, and they were getting towards the end of it, and they said, somebody said, "Okay, we're going to wrap up now." He said, "Oh no, wait, somebody else asked a question. This beautiful lady, I have to take the question."
The old dog.
Oh, smooth. Yeah. Smooth. I also heard he could throw a nail at a dartboard and make it stick.
That's absurd.
Like cast it just out of hand.
That's insane.
Yeah. Although, you figure that like with his well, first of all, like he was recording like death metal and stuff like that, but even his war record and stuff like that, it's the kind of thing that you could remotely be within the realm of possibility. Like I believe if Jean-Claude Van Damme can crack a walnut with any part of his anatomy, I believe Christopher Lee can throw a male at dart bomb.
Jean-Claude Van Damme with any,
with any part of his body.
The acting stakes, certainly.
Yeah. It kind of feels, he's one of those people that's been around so long that you think he's going to be immortal. There's just no end to it.
Did we take him for granted?
Yeah. He's done work all the way up, and I think he's appreciating all the work he's done. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, like, if he
became a sir.
He
did.
Well, that's it. If you look at his filmography, like, I mean, even his later or more recent filmography, on the one hand, you have, like, the Hobbit films, which are among the highest grossing films of the year in question. And on the other hand, you've got him still doing the Hammer horror stuff. Like, he was in The Resident, which is a terrible film, but he's actually quite good in it, as you might expect Christopher Lee to be.
Because he's a pro.
And it's just so full of presence and malevolence and the things we loved him for.
Although when you say that, actually, the first thing I thought about when I heard about his passing wasn't any of those big Christopher Lee roles, because they're so stereotypically Christopher Lee. It was actually his role in The Hand of the Baskervilles in 1959, in which he played Sir Henry, which is completely against type for Lee. And I thought that was, actually, I would argue, one of the better Hammer films, but certainly one of the off-center performances I think of when I think of Lee.
All I can hear now is him singing the Tinker of Rye in The Wicker Man.
I think
him and Diane Colento, she's out there on the rug, and he's at the piano, and they're just they're having a ballyhoo. And then Edward Woodward throws a rabbit at them.
May watch The Wicker Man tonight.
There is a remastered edition out there.
Yeah, I don't have it.
I've watched the theatrical cut, director's cut, and final cut. I can confirm the original theatrical is probably best.
Really?
I think so.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
All right. Yeah.
The completest one's the lot, but I suppose doesn't necessarily mean...
I mean, there's very little difference in them. I think it just... The other two just had time more than anything else. But it doesn't matter how you watch it.
I think I'm going to be watching it again. Yeah. It's been a while.
Oh, I'd like to think him and Edward Woodward are up there having a toast, and Peter Cushing's patting him on the back.
Yeah.
Flaming drambuies all round. Anyway, adieu, Sir Christopher.
Indeed.
Yeah.
On that news, let's move to something that probably isn't going to cheer some of us up, but let's do it anyway. The top 10.
Yay!
This is the top 10 of the last weekend at the Irish box office, and we start at number 10. And much to Jay's chagrin, I'm sure, Danny Collins has not left the top 10. He's hanging on in there.
A bad smell.
Dropped 58%, though.
it must be a bad week if that can sustain he's that there, kind of drop.
Danny Collins is there with less than 15,000 quid for the weekend.
Good lord. There's three films, actually. It's less than 20,000 in a week, which is... I know some are drifting off, but oh lord.
Yeah. Oh dear. Average location, €299. That's not great.
It's okay if you're 10 weeks in the chart and you've made a couple of mil.
It'll limp to 100,000. Yeah,
it's still better than that FIFA film.
Yeah. United Passion. Oh, United how do we not talk about United Passion?
Because it hasn't got a release over here.
And it never will at this rate.
Yes.
Was it? Well, I mean,
because we like soccer over
well,
here.
We certainly like it more than American. And bizarre. I thought it. Now, I don't know if Danny DeVito's been reviewed or anything. I presume it's terrible.
Oh, it is terrible.
Is it?
Oh,
no. But it doesn't have the kind of Princess Monaco.
It has a like the gravity kind of, that thrills you in.
Even worse, it has a score of 1 on Metacritic.
Yeah, I may pass.
1.
Although I'm always curious to watch films that are that dreadful. Just to study them first.
We're still waiting for you to watch Grey's Anatomy.
It hasn't been added to Netflix. It's going to be added very soon, I think. The next couple of weeks.
You're not going to pay just for it, sorry.
Of course I'm not. I'm an idiot.
You could just watch Diana.
I've watched it over... I had to walk into 4 sections.
I know, you make it sound like a much classier film than it is.
It's hysterical.
Like part one, Charles.
It may well be one of the greatest comedies ever made. Accidentally.
like the bit where she just misses the call that would have saved her life.
All that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Gosh. Actually, kind of want to rewatch it.
Or the bit where she sneaks into like her ex-boyfriend's apartment and creepily dresses it up for him.
Oh, God, that's a horrible film.
Stop talking about
can
it.
Can we all watch it and talk back lazy? Come on.
Come on, it'll be great.
Come on, it'll be great.
Live podcast.
I'm in. Yeah.
I'd like to finish the top 10
first. Oh, sorry, yeah, yeah.
Okay,
sorry.
Grace and Monaco coming soon to a podcast near you.
Yes.
No guarantee. At number 9, in its 12th week in the top 10, Home.
And I've seen this.
This is your fault! Oh! You're the one who keeps this up! You!
Well...
Ow!
Was it a home run?
We were babysitting.
No, we...
It was babysitting.
Oh, sure. So,
it's not bad.
Curveball.
It's okay. It's very obvious in the sense that, like, the structure of it is very predictably... Yeah, get to the end. Same kind of three-act structure you've seen in a million animation kind of films. But within that, there's some okay stuff. Like, there's some very entertaining kind of hijinks characterization. The voice work by, I think it's Rihanna.
It is Rihanna.
And
Jim Parsons
is really good. It would be surprisingly good. It adds depth to a story that really doesn't have any. Actually,
and there's the faint phrase.
No, I mean, it's
adds depth where there isn't any.
There's well,
God, this has been found.
There's
there's your pull quote.
It's your basic animation, but no real kind of. There's a couple of kind of sly kind of digs towards colonial kind of things, but it's very light. But mostly the kind of two characters that they play, that they voice, actually you buy into their particular areas of trouble and concern and all that kind of stuff, and that kind of works. So that propels even the most kind of cliche of stuff forward towards a very obvious but relatively satisfying ending. It's okay. And like, I mean, I could see why it stuck around.
Basically, it kept the kids quiet.
Yeah, and I didn't hate it. I liked it.
Yeah. 2 hours of babysitting for €8. Mm.
So basically, better than one all night.
Of course. Of course it is.
But if the alien from Home had landed beside an alcoholic Liam Neeson...
That's the film I want to see.
Yeah, there we go.
Run home all night. Yes.
Should
have made that one, Liam.
Yeah, there we go.
Nice. You two go on.
Call me.
You two go back to your relative homes and your respective homes and go and write that script.
Yes.
At number 8, Avengers Age of Ultron.
This is hanging around
still
also.
Still there.
Over 3 million.
Yep.
Yeah. That's probably got another couple of weeks to kind of knock another couple of hundred thousand
out. Oh, much? Well, not that much.
No,
you get to 3.1, but
it's all right.
Beyond that.
Yeah, I think we got some relatively stacked weeks.
Yeah.
Coming up.
Mm.
In the middle of June, who'd have thought?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's almost as if it's the season.
Yes. At number 7, 2x2. You didn't go see this one as well.
I did not. It was a toss of a coin, Bill.
Doing really well. By the time we've recorded it, we'll definitely have made 1 million.
I don't have any good. I have no idea.
Yeah. Number 6, Tomorrowland, A World Beyond. Oh, dear.
Darren's favourite film of the year.
Yeah, right there. Profitability. also A World Beyond.
A World Beyond.
But,
That's pretty poor, isn't it? I mean, 2x2 has made more money than it's... You kind of worry.
And it's got a George Clooney carrying it, and it's, you know...
Carrying its mediocrity in box office terms, by the looks of it.
One thing that isn't being so mediocre about its box office, or anything else, it basically is better than Tomorrowland in most every way. Mad Max Fury Road, at number 5.
I read it passed 200 million worldwide.
Yeah.
That's not a lot, is it, in relative terms to how much the budget was? The budget's 150 million.
Yeah. Oh, it's past... No, it's well past that now. It's close to 300 million.
No, it's gone past 300 million.
Oh, 300.
Yeah. But
It's not. It's not earth shattering. It's not. Executives
aren't rolling around their beds.
Yeah, you're not going to get a Mad Max shared universe out of this. No. Which is probably a good thing.
Yes.
But.
It's still decent.
It's fuel for a sequel.
Yeah. I like it. Fuel for a sequel.
It's very good film.
I wasn't going for a gag there, but I'll claim it. And. Yeah, I mean it's broken even once you factor in marketing and a few cherries on top.
But I mean, you look at that and you say it's a
and
film.
And keep going.
Yeah, but it's a film, you know, which the last film was released 25 years ago. Yeah. No, more, nearly 30 years ago. Yeah. Like with a different lead actor.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Tom Hardy, as much as people like us love him, like my mom is not going to see a Tom Hardy film because Tom Hardy's in it. Yeah, she's no idea who Tom Hardy is.
Show her a picture. She'll change her mind.
That's why they have to cover his face in all those movies, because otherwise you'll just fall in love. I think to actually get to the point of what I was saying, it's to make that much money on that property at this stage is a good deal. And I think you look at the other case, Tomorrowland is a similar situation. It's got little name recognition. It has got a lead actor with a name. That's the comparison, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I think comparing Mad Max to Age of Ultron is, you know, something that you shouldn't do.
No, I'm intrigued in that regard, because is there an argument to be made that maybe they should have aimed a little higher than Hardy?
No.
I'm not saying he's not a good fit. I'm just in the context.
Oh, in terms of as a business exit,
as a business exit, if you're spending 150 million quid on Mad Max Fury Road, which may not have brand recognition to a large degree,
do you
stick somebody else in there? Now, I don't know.
That's why I think a lot of people love Fury Road, is because it's the kind of thing where if your job depended on this movie doing well financially, it would look a hell of a lot different.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine being in the test screening when that goes down in front of your boss and you're like, yeah, so we gave him 150 million and sent him to, well, first we sent him to Australia and then we sent him to South Africa. And we said, just do what you want. And this happened.
But isn't there a couple of people tweeted a year ago or something on the first test screenings that I remember somebody retweeted a while ago from 2014 saying, I just heard test screening of Fury Road and not good things.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting thing. But I think it works. I really like it. I'm not for a second saying that's a... Like, I think they did right and they did well. I'm just intrigued in box office terms.
Yeah, no.
Would you think somebody's kicking themselves a little bit in that context?
We'll never know, will
I? I'm just intrigued. That's
I would hope that expectations had been, like, managed on it. Like,
yeah, I would hope so. I don't think they were going for, as you said, Avengers money. Like, I mean, of course they weren't.
Yeah.
No one is.
But it's good. I'm glad. And I hope it gets another one, because I'll be there.
Yeah, no, I really, really enjoyed it.
And it is still on the tail of Pitch Perfect 2 at number 4.
It made slightly more money.
It made more, which is...
Bizarre. Good. But okay.
Yeah. Should be noted that Pitch Perfect has actually suffered a bigger drop this week.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, they'll be basically fighting each other all the way
down.
But
Pitch Perfect costs like 30 million. So.
Oh, yeah.
It's an easier...
An easier sell.
Yeah.
And higher profit.
I don't begrudge it its success.
No, I haven't seen it.
Number 3. Boom.
Insipid.
Insidious. Have you seen it, Jay?
Of course I haven't.
Then push.
But we know it's crap, though,
don't we?
Yes, we do.
No, we don't.
Yes,
because everyone knows a good critic always prejudges. It saves time.
Yeah.
I've heard mixed things on it, but apparently better than the last one, which wouldn't be hard by all accounts. And it has grossed 111,000.
But I didn't think much of the first film, so I couldn't imagine it being better than that. So there you go. That's my reasoning.
Everyone knows horror film franchises always pick up on the third film.
Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Friday the 13th, Part 3.
A Nightmare on Elm Street, Part 3.
That's where it's at. All classics. Yes, Creed 3.
What is the masterpiece of the genre. Even if we go outside horror, The Godfather Part 3.
Yeah. Those first two films, they're just building to it, baby.
Yeah. No, you're right. I retract everything I just said. Sorry. Anyway.
Number two. Oh, and I'm sad that Insidious Chapter 3 didn't displace this a bit further. San Andreas.
So you're sad that Insidious didn't shake up the charts enough?
Oh, be quiet.
Oh, fine.
You'd find fault with anything.
Oh. He blindsided me with that one. Shit.
Don't worry. Anyway. He was just trying to rock your world.
Oh, my God. Anyway, at this rate, it'll have grossed over 750,000. Well
bad.
Done, Warners.
Yeah.
I say well done, Paul Giamatti, because he's the only one who deserves any claim on that.
I doubt you went to see it for Paul Giamatti.
Yeah,
I know you Paul did, Giamatti. But it's a you're the small amount of the target market.
I love the
Giamatti fans, a tiny little sliver of a pie chart.
I love the idea of the midnight screenings where people are queuing up outside with their Paul Giamatti shirts, you know, arguing whether Sideways or, you know,
American Splendor.
Who the hell are you?
Amazing Spider-Man 2 or nothing.
And we see the Paul Giamatti, 0.003% of the target audience.
Me.
It's picture of Philip on the chart.
Hello to Paul Giamatti.
We do love you.
You are actually the best thing about it.
But I'm glad to say, at number one, here's that happy ending you were talking about last week. Jay.
Indeed.
Spy.
Yeah.
Number one.
Still well okay. above. Very, very good.
Over 250,000 opening weekend. And yay.
Didn't get to see it the last. I will get to see it.
I did get.
Everybody's saying good things.
Yeah.
I saw it again.
Really?
Woo! I was dragged in. Well, not dragged. It was suggested and it was the best of the options suggested.
Okay. What other options were actually? Let me ask.
Pitch Perfect 2.
Okay.
No, that's fair enough.
Yeah.
It's a blast. It's not perfect by any manner
no,
of means.
But
it's broad.
Not pitch perfect.
No.
Uh-oh.
And a bit too long. But hey, it's good fun.
It is. A great cast.
Well, I know one person Jay's going to see.
Who would that be?
Mr. Statham.
Yes.
That'd be the state of affairs then, would
yeah.
it?
Of all people to be a Statham fan. I mean, it kind of...
Crank and Crank
always surprises
are
us.
Bloody brilliant.
You know, the moment.
Really?
Yeah, they're brilliant films.
I thought you were a big Transporter fan, too.
The first one's okay.
Everyone knows it was building to Transporter 3.
Also, I like the Bank Job.
I mean, you know, the moment Jay can't surprise us is the moment this podcast isn't worth doing.
What Darren said.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yes.
Let us move on, finally. And I say that.
The sound of relief. Yeah, the sound of relief.
I feel like you're going to weep.
Anyway.
Yes.
Let us move on to this week's new releases.
Okay.
Give us a cheer.
Yay!
Please release me, let me go.
And we'll start relatively small and work our way up, I think. Let's start with Let Us Pray. Anybody?
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought the direction was very good. Like, it looks really,
that
really
is some
good.
Good faint praise right there.
That is, yeah, that is some qualification
yeah.
laid along there.
Before you go any further, shall we just explain what Let Us Pray is?
Okay.
Horror film
about a bunch of people in a police station in Scotland, and then crazy stuff starts happening when the new arrival on the force brings in mysterious prisoner number 6, played by Liam Cunningham.
The officer being played by, is this
Pollyanna McIntosh?
I like Pollyanna McIntosh. She's good.
Yeah.
Mm, good actress.
Yeah.
Liam Cunningham, well, he's always solid.
Liam Neeson. Sorry. Oh.
We know where you're at.
Yeah, there we go. There's only one Liam for me.
An alcoholic an alcoholic prisoner.
No. In fact, that's the thing. This prisoner is anything but your usual Saturday night drunkard.
Yes. I like Liam Cunningham. It's good.
So hilarity ensues. And by hilarity, I mean lots and lots of depravity. And blood, hyper-stylized violence, beautifully shot. Doesn't make a lick of sense.
we like
those. But no, I mean, like, it's not... It looks really... It captures the feel of, like, early sort of John Carpenter. And it has this...
Yeah.
Jesus, okay. You're really...
That's aiming high.
Yeah.
Okay, the look. Maybe not the...
not the feel.
Maybe,
or
maybe,
the intent.
Or the writing.
The
or the... no, but, like Brian O'Malley is a great director. I'm sure he's going to go on to great things. But it does feel like perhaps the script might have used a little bit of work.
So a good script with this director, you were saying?
Oh, I'd be there. I'd be there day one. And it has a wonderful opening sequence, a wonderfully effective opening sequence, which perfectly sets the mood of the film. And it's literally just like Liam Cunningham walks across Scotland. And
I like the sound of that.
I know, really.
Under the Skin, the remix.
Yeah. Yeah.
But with Liam Cunningham. Yeah. What's not to like?
You see, he got off the motorbike, took his helmet off and started walking.
Oh, that
was there. There's a jump on point for a
yeah.
sequel.
Yeah. But yeah, no, not a great film of itself. Very stylishly, looks lovely. Performances are solid, particularly the two, Pollyanna McIntosh and Liam Cunningham. But it has a lot of problems.
Oh.
Well,
yes. As you say, though, director one to watch.
Yep, director one to watch.
Okay. I'm afraid I'm going to blindside you both because there's one film I didn't include on your list of new releases.
Okay, blindside away, Philip.
Black Coal, Thin Ice.
I've heard good things about this.
I've heard very good things. This won the Golden Bear at Berlin earlier in the year, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Praise for a start. Chinese drama in which an ex-cop and his former partner decide to follow up on an investigation of murders. And they decided to do this because, one, their botching of the investigation originally got them fired, and two, the murders start again.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. But yeah, this has been getting a lot of great reviews.
Yeah.
And as grim as it sounds,
it's just fascinating.
Well worth it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
That's from Chinese director Yinan Jiao. And yeah, this could well be the one to watch this weekend, although it could well have competition from The Look of Silence.
Yes, as I like to call it, my Star Wars.
He's not kidding,
folks. Cannot wait to see this. I'll be seeing it this weekend, and I'll report back next week.
Please do.
But I'm a huge fan of Joshua Oppenheimer and The Act of Killing, which is
this is the follow-up.
It's probably my second or third favourite film this decade so far.
Whoa.
It's in certain top five, I can't remember where I've placed it. But the follow-up has been getting serious praise also. And we're back in Indonesia again, this yeah. time from a different kind of perspective, I think.
The Act of Killing it's quite unique. I've never seen anything
yeah.
like it, in which the perpetrators of crime, basically genocide,
they
reenact the crimes theatrically.
In the style of their favourite genre films that they watched in the era when they committed the crimes.
Very odd.
And
this is probably a bit more straightforward
yeah.
in that it's being told from the victim's point of view.
Yeah.
I've no doubt it's going to be harrowing.
Listen, nobody's come to see this for the comedy aspects, relatively speaking, but it's probably going to be heavy going to some degree. But, I mean, as a follow-up to an astonishing film, I'm there.
Well, we know where Jay will be.
I'm sure it'll knock Spy off number one next week.
Yeah, or else he'll lose faith in you all. You all.
What?
Yeah. Listeners.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Sorry, listeners. Go see it or I'll kill you all. I mean, lose faith in you all.
what was the pick last week? Just so we know where you're ranking on the top 10.
Let's switch to something a little less heavy. Jesus Christ. What the hell, Jay?
I said you all.
And you're dead. And
That's
you're
not
dead.
My issue.
And you're dead.
I'm going to shoot you, and you.
You don't have a cinema showing this film, but you could have driven 2 hours.
Lazy? I think so.
Yeah. Next.
Yes,
he knows when
Queen of
sleeping.
Country. Queen of Country. Yes, something a little lighter. Film set in wartime. Hooray!
Yay.
No, this is the aforementioned new film by John Borman. And the most unlikely sequel, I suppose, his follow-up to Hope and Glory, which, as I mentioned earlier, was his retelling of his life during the Blitz. Now he's a few years older, it's the early 50s in Britain, and he's just been conscripted into the army to help train soldiers to go fight in Korea.
Okay.
I like it. It's, for a film with its militaristic setting, in the same way Hope and Glory had its setting during World War II, it's oddly light and enjoyable.
So the tone is kept?
The tone is kept. I would say perhaps a bit more to this film's detriment because you're dealing with some heady material, like this version of Borman, his on-screen persona, played by Callum Turner in this version. He's very good, actually. But he's very much a pacifist, and he holds that stance all the way through. Not in any loud, vociferous way, but just by circumstance. You know, you think enough about the war and you realise, well, what a folly.
Yeah.
But it does mean that they're, like Hope and Glory, it's more episodic than given a set narrative. So there's a lot of little things where the film's at its best when he sees him interacting with his family, and we get some of the old characters back, and that's wonderful to see. But at the same time, he's dealing with stuff in the barracks that... Like one of the key points is where they're trying to find a clock that's been stolen from the sergeant's mess. Based on true events.
But necessary to the...
It's kind of, yeah.
Little.
It's a bit not flippant, but just...
Certainly out of place. Away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's not to say there isn't a lot to like. As led by Turner, the cast is very likeable. Sinead Cusack's in there, Tamsin Egerton. Richard E. Grant and David Thewlis turn up, and they're excellent.
In fact, always welcome. As well,
Thewlis is actually probably the best performer of the lot.
He generally is.
Kind of like a drill sergeant, but not that kind of drill sergeant. More stiff upper lip,
like his character in The Big Lebowski.
Not as
that's a drill sergeant I want to see in a film.
Very different territory, but still very good. We like David Thewlis.
Yes, we do.
It's very nicely shot, lovely score. I mean,
nice seems to be the word that you think.
Yeah, I can't fault the production. I think
it needed a bit more
profundity. When I heard it may not have bite, but it does have charm.
Okay, good enough.
Bring your granny; she might like it. Although that seems a bit dismissive as well. No.
Also, my grannies are gone.
I meant that.
That was very insensitive.
Yeah,
Phil.
Still raw. Phil.
He threatened to kill half our listenership.
No, I said I'd try to kill all our listeners.
I'm about to say, are you assuming half the listeners are going to go see it?
I hope so.
Okay.
They should have exquisite taste like we do.
Well, they do because they picked this podcast.
Indeed.
Speaking of exquisite taste, the last of the new releases this week, and undoubtedly the biggest. Yeah, I think The Look of Silence is going to have competition in the top 10.
Yeah, it's going to be a tussle for number one, but we'll see who runs out at the end.
It's Jurassic World. It is, of course, the third sequel. Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
The third sequel to the original Jurassic Park, but now we're in the future!
Can I say a couple of things to start off?
I will point out that Darren is the one who's seen it.
Can Darren say a few things? I didn't think he'd seen it.
No, go for it, Jay.
I'd like to hear Jay's take.
I want to hear this.
This could be good.
I've got two things to say, right?
Okay.
One, I was kind of tweeting about this yesterday a little bit. I was 18 when I saw Jurassic Park in the cinema when it came out. A little older, I think, than maybe the target audience for it at the time. I think it was a kind of... I was just
PG-13.
Yeah, a little bit. And I liked it. And there's some great moments in Jurassic Park. But I don't think it's a particularly great film. And so...
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. And Niall is kind of just jolted up in the seat wherever he's sitting going, who said that? But...
I'd like to second this point.
Yeah. And so it never had the seismic impact on me that it did a lot of people. Now, I understand for a lot of people it's their Star Wars moment of an age where you see a film that blows your mind on the big screen, see a dinosaur coming across the screen, all that kind of stuff. I get that.
And plus its influence at the box office and...
Sure. And
it dominated.
That's fine. I get all that. And I hope people that...
Over a year, the dinosaurs rule the Earth once again.
Yeah. So, taking that aboard, the other thing is that there are people who will go see this and are really looking forward to going seeing this, who probably get on people's case or get on filmmakers' case or whatever for the amount of sequels that are being shown and being made and being of particular films, of older films and everything, where that this isn't going to get the same grief for. Like, as in, this is as Philip said, the third sequel to a film. And yet seems to get a pass for some reason from a lot of people.
Has it?
Yeah, from fans who are willing to accept it a lot more than, say, certain critics.
Because like my general perception from talking to people about this is like it's a sense of anticipation, not necessarily of excitement and hope, but...
Well, they're
like,
afraid that's going to crap.
That's it. Like there is a desperate clinging fear there.
Yeah, but that's nothing to do with whether it should be made or not, or whether it should exist or not.
It's just that something is tickling their nostalgia.
Yeah. And that's interesting, but not necessarily
It's not right. Is that the best basis for a film? It is if you're looking at the money, I suppose. But
and no doubt it will make the money. Oh, but yeah. I'd like to hear what Darren thought. I'm intrigued.
Well, no. Just to go back there. Like, I mean, in terms of like people like us tend to sort of jump on the like the sequel hating bandwagon. But
easily.
Yeah, we. No. I'm agreeing entirely. Yeah. I'm just like hypothetical devil's advocate, though. I mean, like outside people like us. I mean, do you think that there are people who look at like Captain America 3 and go, "That's too much," or the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot and go, "That's too much," or is that just people who pay attention like us?
Put it this way: I think Marvel is unique in the sense that it's building a universe, so you can get away with anything within the universe. It would seem, right? But we'll see if DC can get away with it. But Marvel seem to get away with it. But I'm talking about, you see sequels too. And I think before Mad Max came out, I think people would have been a bit, and the same trepidation. And then they're going, is there really a point to making a film? See, why didn't you just start again as a new film?
Yeah.
You know, and just kind of completely. And aside from that, you get the horror remakes, which there's a ton of.
Yeah. And which make money, which indicates. Which
is, see, that's the thing.
Yeah.
But I think you get people just throwing their kind of
Friday nights away.
I don't know. I don't know. You'll always still have the original films. I don't think it ever really matters whether it's a sequel or a remake.
Because I don't necessarily want the second and third films. But there you go. No,
I don't either.
I will fight you over Lost World. Actually, I won't fight you. I'll just take it because you don't want it.
I don't want it.
Yeah. I think that it's fine to exist. If you love Jurassic Park, then that's going nowhere, no matter how many sequels exist. But it gets increasingly cynical and awful. And I just... It doesn't do anything for me, so I've kind of essentially zero interest in seeing it. Yeah. But I'm intrigued as to the reaction to it, and really some 4 or 5 star reviews, which I'm kind of surprised by.
I haven't seen any 5.
I've seen a 5.
Oh, good lord.
Yeah, there's a lot of weird love out there from places that I would have thought... I mean, I was going to say that I would have thought better of, but that sounds very snarky.
I think that sounds just about snarky.
No, we're all for snarky here.
Yeah.
You'll never be Jay in those takes, but go ahead.
But I mean,
so tell us, Darren, is it cynical and crap as he fears?
It is incredibly cynical. It is, and here's the thing: it's okay. Basically, so the plot of Jurassic World, as the name implies, is that it's set in like an alternative present where somehow they've managed to take the dino park from the first film that killed lots of people and became like an insurance nightmare. Turn it into a functioning Disney World type place where people travel over.
It's a different place, isn't it?
I believe it's Isle of Nibula. Yeah,
it's
the same place. And in fact, yeah, there's... Well, we'll get to that in a second because the movie is as nostalgic as you would expect it to be. But they managed to build a theme park around, and the theme park is built around a very clear sense of nostalgia within the film itself. And there's a point where, on one stage, the self-awareness is quite clever. So you have, like... You have the cameos from, like, the familiar dinosaurs. Or you have the, you know, the little DNA guy from the first film, the animation. He pops up.
That little guy.
Or you have the, the monuments built to the mosquito in the amber. Things that are designed within the world of Jurassic World.
To let you know you're okay here.
Yeah. Like, there's a point when they arrive and the tour guide is like, these are the original gates to the park. And you're like, what? That's great for me as a person who's watching the film. But, like, in this world, didn't dozens of people die behind those
also,
gates?
Also, yeah, exactly. This is to be proud of.
Yeah.
In film, knowing terms, fine.
Yeah. But, I mean, like, there's a point where it feels like Jurassic World dislikes itself as much as I am skeptical of it. In that the film's central point, right, and this is a film where it remixes and strips out lots of different scenes from the original film over and over again. So you have stuff like, and this is not without, well, this is completely without spoilers, you have sequences where the electric shock fence from the original film makes a silent cameo. Where, it was a really character in that film. But you have
great
stuff.
Great scene in it, though.
Yeah, you have the visitor's center, you have the. The T-Rex from the original Jurassic Park, the director described this as his Unforgiven. And you can make that reading of the film if you want. I don't think it's necessary, because the film doesn't set it up whatsoever. But it's just like, hey, here's that dinosaur you liked from the original film, and it's here because you liked it in the original film.
Not for any other reason.
Not for any other reason. And it comes almost out of nowhere. In terms of, like, it just arrives and it's there, and it's like you're meant to bask in its nostalgic glory. And the film is cynically aware of this. And I'm like, that doesn't make it good. That doesn't justify it.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that you know that I'm as skeptical of you as I am doesn't mean that you get a pass on it.
Also, it makes you can actually imagine get quite annoying in a little way.
It does. Like, the central plot of the film is that these people who have, like, you've got a dinosaur theme park open. I think you're in the clear now. You've somehow cleared it with all your insurance people. You've got hundreds of thousands of people going, hey, I know that an entire expedition died, but, I mean, playing the odds, we're safe, right? That's only going to happen once. Going over and visiting it. And yet all of a sudden you've got them designing this new super dinosaur. I think it's called, like, the Imperial Rex. Although, don't quote me on that. And it's...
You're just at the point you lost me as any point in
really?
Like,
really? Because you were so open-minded in your introduction.
No. I wasn't, like... It just even like, hang on, hang on. This is exactly what I was.
But the super dinosaur, super predator, if you will, is designed by chopping and changing bits of existing dinosaurs in the way that the film itself is designed from chopping and changing little bits of Jurassic Park.
But it knows it.
But it knows it. But that's not the thing. Like, the climax of the film is built without getting spoilers, is this idea of that genetically modified dinosaur perhaps coming into conflict with symbols of the franchise's nostalgia. And the way that the film resolves those issues leads me to believe, basically, the film seems to argue for its own irrelevance. And if I've spent 2 hours watching your film, I don't want you to tell me that you suck compared to the original Jurassic Park, because I could have just watched the original Jurassic Park. It is, like, there's a point where the cleverness is cute, and it goes well past that point. There is a point where, like, the direction is quite good. It does homage, effectively.
What point does homage end and rip off begin?
Yeah, well, that's it. The point is, like, if I want to remember the experience of watching Jurassic Park, I will stick in Jurassic Park.
Like, give me something different. Like,
that's it. Like, like you guys railed on me for liking The Lost World last week.
I didn't.
Okay. Phil railed on me.
I wasn't too fussed one way either.
Yeah, I didn't care. I simply didn't care. But, there's a bit at the start where, like, Ian Malcolm is like, where John Hammond's like, don't worry, we're not going to make the same mistakes this time. And Ian Malcolm's like, no, you're making entirely new mistakes. And I'm like, yes. That's what The Lost World is. Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It did try to do something.
It's in the same world, but it's doing something new with it.
Yes. And
this seems to be in a whole new futuristic world, and it's making the same mistakes.
Yeah, it's a remix. It's very much a remix.
This sounds cowardly in the sense that they hadn't got the nerve to do anything new for fear of losing out. So if they remix enough nostalgia with the original to give them some of the original's DNA, to sell it all back to the same people who own Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cynical.
Yeah, and I mean...
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't
but I mean, if you want to get even more cynical, like the
go
new...
On,
then, oh, yeah, here we go. here we go.
This is my Christmas card.
let's dig into this. Like, the elements that are new are all... there are a few new elements, and they're all incredibly cynical. Like, you look at the original Jurassic Park, and, like, you look at the three lead actors in it, right? They're Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and Jeff Goldblum. They are pretty much three B-movie actors. Like,
great
cast. No,
they're fantastic actors. They're great to have.
But they're not actors you would put in a blockbuster summer film. Like,
which is why you've got that works. In
yeah. Like, Sam Neill is like Damien from The Omen. Laura Dern works with David Lynch frequently.
Yeah. And Jeff Goldblum is
the fly. Yeah. And you put them in this big budget summer blockbuster where they're all playing nerds. And, like, you know, Ian Malcolm.
We love them. Because you can identify with it to some degree.
Yeah,
because it makes them a little bit more human, which is needed because the script was not the strongest point of the original film.
But then if you look at what Jurassic World does, it strips out, it doesn't have those characters. It slots in
Star-Lord.
It slots in generic male and female lead number one and two. So you have Chris Pratt, who I like Chris Pratt. I think he does, like, charming and affable all the way, but I think the character is like a composite of focus group tested traits in that he's a free spirit who can't be tamed, who lives in a bungalow in inverted commas and is sensitive to animals, but he's also a Marine who has served his country and thus can be trusted.
So it covers every base.
It covers every possible base. And on the other hand, you've got Bryce Dallas Howard playing...
The role Thankless doesn't come even close to it.
It is an abominable role. Like,
so I've heard.
Jurassic Park, the dinosaurs are prehistoric and so are the gender politics. Because the entirety of Jurassic World is basically about how Bryce Dallas Howard's character is a really crappy mother and how dozens, if not hundreds, of people die from that fact. Like, there's a point...
That's a wonderful thing to tell the kids.
That is a wonderful thing to tell kids. Like, basically, her personal life is, you know, two relatives... Yeah, well, no. Two relatives are sent to the park to be
replace
under...
the kids that came in the original
yeah,
movie, of course.
Yeah.
Yay, children in peril. What a cheap and cynical vehicle that is.
And they're sent basically to... they're sent to her and she fobs them off because she's busy doing work stuff. Because, you know, women can't have work and family, apparently.
No, you
this
pick
is,
one or the other.
Yeah, this is the 70s, people.
Yeah.
but...
The 1870s.
The 1870s. But so she fobs them off and this leads to them being placed in danger. So that's on her.
Yeah.
According to the film's morality. Like, there's a point where she shows up and she's like, Chris Pratt, I know that you don't like me and I know that you've got lots, like, other stuff to be doing in this catastrophe, but I need you to help find my two nephews. And Chris Pratt is like, okay, what do they look like? And she's like, they're like, you know, she's difficulty remembering the finer details. She can't remember their ages because she hasn't...
Because she's busy?
Because she's busy and she hasn't seen them in years because she works in a park with dinosaurs. But no, like, the film pauses to have Chris Pratt look at her and go... You don't even know your own nephew's ages.
He say it?
He actually says it, and the scene ends on that, as if, like, this is what you're to take away from this sequence.
She's the worst person in the world.
Yeah, and, like, things start going terrible until he says, look, I'm in charge out here. At which point, she starts following him, and things get better. Like, there's a point where she's being chased by velociraptors, and, like, she's fighting for survival, and then Chris Pratt rides up on a motorbike beside her. He's like, follow me, everything will be okay, and everything is okay. But, I mean, on top of that, the actual Super Predator dinosaur, right? It's very much designed to be her baby, in inverted commas, and that she designed it and she cared for it. But no, wait for it. It gets better.
Good. So we're into alien territory.
We're into alien territory. But, like, in case you didn't get the commentary on her personal life, the dinosaur is sociopathic because it has never known love, because she raised it in a cage separate from other dinosaurs, and she never... She never engaged. She never engaged with it personally. Like, you have, on the other
hand, with it personally, except
like, you have Chris Pratt, who shows up to lecture her, and he's like, this dinosaur has never known love.
Oh yeah,
thanks, Chris.
Well, yeah. By the way, just to point out, I do know that in this film, Chris Pratt plays a raptor.
Oh, no,
he's trained for velociraptors.
But here's the thing, right? So,
no, I'm sorry, but how friggin' stupid is that?
That comes up with it, because he's like, when he's arguing about how bad a mother she is, this dinosaur, he's like, but look at my four velociraptors. When they were born, I made sure I was the first thing to imprint on them. It's like... Bryce Dallas,
I'm a better
mother than you, and dozens of people will die because of that fact. It really feels like somebody should have read the script and maybe took out a red pen.
I think somebody's agent should have read the script saying, hey, we're not doing this.
Yeah.
Dallas Howard, God love her. She's being sunk with it on a mini bad film.
Yeah. And she's not a terrible actress.
It's like, okay, I don't mind her at all, actually.
Yeah, I haven't seen a lot of proof to that, but I'll take your word for it.
I don't mind her most of it. She just gets saddled with the worst parts. Yeah. Pretty much in everything.
Well, you know what? She's doomed to a very unflattering part. Anyway, the poor man's Jessica Chastain. Yeah.
To the point where Jessica Chastain recorded a song explaining that Bryce Dallas Howard is not Jessica Chastain.
Hey, I'd like to make a disclaimer on that as well. What are you
Let me ask you something, though. This sounds... You want to say something first?
No, go ahead.
This sounds dreadful. Darren, now I'm waiting for the book. It has several amusing scenes that end, and I didn't end on a happy note, but I don't know where you're going with this.
Well, okay. Thanks for the challenge, Jay.
You're welcome, Darren.
Go for it. It is. Like, the direction is okay. It is an effective homage in that it reminds you of the things that it is meant to remind you of.
A lot.
To the point where you come out in the cinema and you go, hey, Jurassic Park was actually a good film. You don't go, Jurassic World is a good film and I want to see it again. Let alone, I want to see the sequels that they're obviously setting up. There's a really awkward third act setup for a sequel that is very, very, very blatant. And trained velociraptors. Because everybody loved that about Jurassic Park 3. We need more velociraptors that you can communicate with. They aren't human enough. That's the problem.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
I genuinely, and I'm not joking, Phil, I'll send it to you later, read a 5-star review of this today. From a critic, not like some guy on Letterboxd. How, Darren?
As I said, this is the bit where I open with, and I said, from people who, and if I was snooty, I'd say, should know better. No, I mean, different strokes for different folks.
Sure.
Different strokes.
I'm not surprised some people
like
it.
That's the principle we as critics operate on.
Yeah, snigger, respect snigger, for everybody else's views.
Yeah.
I haven't got respect for mine yet, so...
Well, I mean, you know, go on. You are at a table with a guy who likes The Lost World, to put that in perspective.
But that sounds like a masterpiece compared to this.
Yeah.
It does, actually. It does. At least it's some, like, it... I kind of want to go and see it more now, weirdly. Just actually see the awfulness of it.
Oh, he's going to go and hate watch, basically.
I might go and hate watch. I may. I have enough films to be seen this weekend, so I'm going to be wrong. But I'm tempted. Oh, man, I'm tempted.
That's the joy. People, in case you're wondering what it's like to be a film critic, hate watching is like 70% of the job.
I know.
Particularly this time of year.
I never hate watch. I refuse. I'm naive.
Never review angry.
Oh, yeah. That's just...
But
yeah, considering
I'm not reviewing this film, I'd be pretty fine to hate watch it.
On that note,
oh, I did see Mr. Holmes though, and that was quite pleasant.
Well,
just to close on a good piece,
nice finish. That
we'll talk more on Mr. Holmes next week when it's released. But in the meantime, we'll wait and see if Jay will go and see Jurassic World.
Spoiler: he probably won't.
But he can sink his teeth into. It's a sequel with some bite.
Oh, stop. No. I'm putting this to an end. An end, you hear?
Bye.
Bye.